from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is January 20th, 2019, Monday morning, also Martin Luther King Day. We're going to observe that fact on this show. Second half hour of the program, we're going to have a conversation with Kevin Christie, a state representative from White River Junction. He's African-American. He chairs the Vermont Human Rights Commission, and which keeps track of instances of discrimination in the state. And I want to get Representative Christie just to sort of opine with us when he gets on the phone with us to ask him, what is the state of the state for people of color in Vermont these days? And well, I'm sure he'll have some interesting insights and information for us as we speak with him in a little bit. Later on in the program, we are going also to have an interesting conversation, I think, with Mike Fisher. He's the healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid, which has been collecting up statements from Vermonters about the difficulty of affording and accessing healthcare in the state. It's really become an increasing problem as insurance rates and general costs go up year after year. Folks are finding themselves being knocked to the roadside by the healthcare system financially, and it's not a pretty picture out there. We'll be talking with Mike Fisher about that in the second hour. First, we want to bring in, though, a last-minute addition to the program here. Just lined up a guest, James Ellers, former radio host here on WDEV, comes back out in his advocacy for clean water role with us. And James Ellers is going to be talking to us about some legislation that is being proposed in Montpelier relating to clean water in the state, and a study that Mr. Ellers and his allies believe needs to happen. I believe James is on the line with us. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
Happy Monday morning. Happy Martin Luther King Day.
Yep, all that to you as well. And I wanted to check in with you to find out, now, are you still with the Lake Champlain International?
I am. I don't do this sort of legislative advocacy on their behalf, but I'm still with the organization.
Got it. Okay. And James, you are talking about ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and worried about its possible occurrence related to cyanobacteria, cyanotoxin, in Vermont's waterways. Tell us about what the concern is here and what you want to do about it.
Dave, we know that cyanotoxins can aerosolize, and for listeners that are not familiar with the issue, blue-green algae is more appropriately referred to as cyanobacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And cyanobacteria at times can produce both hepatotoxins and neurotoxins. Historically, the Department of Health has done a decent job of letting us know of the risk associated with drinking cyanobacteria late in water or recreating in it. But most Vermonters, I'd say all Vermonters, are smart enough not to drink putrid pea soup green water that smells like a cow barn.
Mm-hmm.
But the risk from that cyanobacteria aerosolizing, getting into the air and being carried by the water vapor in the air, is the one that our Department of Health has not been as out in a leadership role as many of us think they should be. And the reason why that's concerning is with the prevalence of these cyanobacteria outbreaks in particularly Addison County, Franklin County, in and around the islands, and even in Burlington, there's the risk that we're breathing these cyanobacteria, cyanotoxins, just in the normal course of where we live.
Yeah, I mean, so basically what we're talking about is particles essentially escaping the water that you're looking at and getting into the air, and then you are breathing them in, and that is potentially a real health risk.
Well, we know it's a health risk. We know that there's all sorts of respiratory issues associated with inhaling cyanobacteria. What is this area of research that is concerning, as it should be, is that these cyanotoxins are being linked to the various forms of dementia, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, but most notably ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. For our doctors and researchers to be able to do a better job at identifying the problem and a cure, we've been looking for the state of Vermont to require and keep a registry so that these researchers can access data. And to this point, we do this for other diseases, cancer, heart disease, but most notably to this point, despite the requests from doctors at UVM, doctors at Dartmouth, the executive branch has not undertaken this voluntarily, so we have decided to turn to the legislature.
Yeah, and what kind of luck have you had so far in the legislature?
It hasn't been taken up just because it was introduced. I should first extend gratitude to Representative Chena of Burlington,
mm-hmm.
who did not need any convincing when I raised this issue with him, and he worked to introduce the bill. So H 258 now is been assigned to the House Healthcare Committee, which Chairman Lippert presides over.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Ann Donahue is the vice chair. And I believe Representative Briglin is the ranking member. All that said, it was introduced last session, and it did not see any action. And that's a little disappointing, but perhaps it just got caught up in all the other things that our legislature is wrestling with. So this session, we're going to be a little bit more aggressive about asking Chairman Lippert to take testimony and advance this bill. And given the fact that I believe all of us, any of us who have known someone with ALS, and what we're asking for is, we think, very reasonable, that it should move once people are aware it's there.
What kind of evidence exists already that there is a link between cyanotoxin and ALS?
Well, there is considerable research that dates back half a century at this point of the biomagnification of cyanotoxins in seeds through the food chain.
Hmm.
So in the island of Guam, and the reason why this this research is so important and powerful is because that population is rather isolated compared to the rest of us. So that eliminates a lot of other factors.
Yeah.
The proliferation of BMAA, which is a cyanotoxin, through seeds, fruit bats that eat these seeds, the native population that was eating the fruit bats, the occurrence of ALS and other dementia-related diseases was astronomical.
Hmm.
And so this is where it gets beyond my expertise. I don't even play a doctor on TV, Dave, as you know. But Dr. Stommel is one of the, literally one of the world's leading researchers. He lives in Vermont, and he practices at Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Tandon at the University of Vermont Medical Center. If you haven't had them on your program, those are the clinicians and researchers that have devoted their lives to treating patients with ALS, as well as spending any of their extra time working to find a cure. So I would encourage you, and I certainly would be happy to help put you in touch with those medical professionals, Drs. Stommel and Dr. Tandon.
Well, we can talk about that. That's a good thought. I appreciate that. Your own advocacy here, I mean, what's next? Are you hoping that the committee will schedule some time in the coming weeks to talk about this legislation?
Yeah, I'm actually hoping they'll do a bit more than just schedule time. I'm hoping they'll schedule a time with the knowledge that they're going to take a vote on it, not just schedule time for appearances.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, the administration has already been asked, and the commissioner of the Department of Health just flat out turned down the medical community, citing predominantly cost, that it's just too expensive to set up this database. And we think that's a really poor reason not to help these selfless professionals that are dedicated to finding a cure to this awful disease, to get them the tools that they need. And because cyanobacteria outbreaks are so prevalent here in Vermont, you know, the concern is very, very real. Like, we know people are being impacted by breathing, being exposed to cyanobacteria, friends and neighbors right here in Vermont. So I can understand why they don't want to draw attention to this issue. The appearance of cyanobacteria is devastating to the tourism economy. But the whole notion that people living in and around these waterfront communities could be exposed to really harmful diseases, I think we know how
yeah, that's not
that
a pretty
be.
Picture for sure. But I mean, if there is a possibility there, it would strike me as beyond malpractice not to pursue the research here, isn't it? I mean, I don't really. Well, I'm trying to connect the dots here and figure out.
Yeah, well, I don't know what we don't know, right? None of us do.
Yeah,
we don't know what we don't know, and the reason for this is, you know, over the years, those of us who have advocated were, I believe, wrongly marginalized as just attempting to scare people. But unfortunately, time has been on our side, and things become more and more clear of just how concerning cyanotoxins are, the negative impacts it has on our health. So if anything, I think it's necessary to pass this legislation so that we can rule out cyanotoxins as a major cause of the dementia-related illnesses.
Is there any evidence that ALS is occurring in, say, lakeshore communities at any higher rate than it would be the case elsewhere?
There have been some studies, and there appears to be higher rates of occurrences in a couple of Vermont communities of which I'm aware.
And are they, in fact, in this region around the lake?
You know, Dave, I rather than unnecessarily scare people, I think the researchers would be the ones best to answer that in detail.
Okay.
Because there are other factors, and it's not a straight shot, so to speak, and, you know, if A, then B.
Yeah, okay.
But yes, you know, these doctors at Dartmouth and the University of Vermont would not be wasting people's time looking for data to help treat their patients, find a cure, if there wasn't solid grounds to do so.
I wonder, hope that's the case. Yeah. Huh. All right. Well, James Ehlers, I think you've stated an interesting case here. We're going to follow up and perhaps get some of these medical professionals on our air in the coming weeks to talk about this issue. Obviously, it's not a happy topic, but it's one that needs to be addressed if it's at all a risk to the general public. And so I thank you very much for highlighting it for us this morning.
Thank you, Dave. And also a shout out to Senator Lyons, who, even though there is not a bill currently in the Senate, has expressed interest in seeing somehow that this issue gets resolved. Because if the executive branch decided that they wanted to do it, we wouldn't need the legislation.
Yeah, okay.
But currently, the governor and his health commissioner have not been helpful.
All right. Thanks again, James. We'll talk soon. Dave from Plainfield's on the line. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. How are you doing from over at Ben's Bookstore? I'm glad you put that out about calling in, because I had a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. Do it real quick, because I've trained my radio voice to just get on and off quick on
other
shows. And first thing was about next time you're talking about the the prostitution issue and legalizing workers, you know, and the decriminalizing the workers for the progressive women. One thing you can do, just a suggestion, is bring up the subject, because I do this on the radio, bring up the subject of Canada, okay, where prostitution is totally legal, at least in Quebec anyway. And I got a French-Canadian lady who lived next door to me for many years, and she has all sorts of things to say about this. I've learned about the issue from her and the Canadian bit. But it seems to me, Dave, that the state of Vermont in general ignores this simple little issue. I go into the great lengths past that. But that's just one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, you had on Dave Zuckerman the other morning, and I think it's real important that we, from here on in this 21st century, and let's really know who's getting in the office. He said something about pot that I really want to, I'm going to find him in public and tell him, do you realize what you said? You know, he said that we needed pot stores, which I'm the guy that's been arrested for it all his life. We need pot stores in Vermont to regulate the industry, sort of the quality. That's what he said, the quality. And do away with the black market. Dave, I'm sure he has smoked pot his whole life, as all of us have. And all the pot we've smoked our whole lives has come from the black market, which I can tell you stories now. The first person I bought pot from in Vermont was a farmer in Bridport in 1974 who had harvested a bunch in a silo. But it was chopped up, very crudely chopped up stuff in a silo. He'd only sell you a pound for $150. That's $9 an ounce. But that's your... And the second person I bought it from was a guy that was blind, or just about blind, up in Cabot, who'd wander around with his dogs. He needed to get $400 a year to pay his taxes, so I contributed $100. Those are the two first people coming from New York I bought pot. There's your black market, you know. And anyway, no. Our idea of smoking pot is to smoke as cheap as possible, all of us. And somebody's bringing me an ounce of pot over here tomorrow, and somebody brought me an ounce last month, and I don't have to pay anything, Dave. So he's got to understand that. No, we're supposed to spend as little on pot. The hell with the stores. It'll turn into... No, the other thing is, has he paid attention like I have to everything that's gone on? Mass legalized it a couple of years ago, and it has been heck getting stores in there. And you know who's a big help in dealing with it was Elizabeth Warren, because there's a lot of ins and outs, and I've been reading this in the Boston Globe. So I'd like to know if he's going to be governor, if he has done what I've done and just paid attention to that mess in Massachusetts with the stores. So I just had those two issues, because it's a 21st century, and it's really complicated now, and we got to start being 21st century thinkers, spend a lot more time thinking. And that's what Homer St. Francis said. Nobody thinks enough.
All right. Well, Dave, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. We'll try to do some more thinking over the course of the coming days and weeks. And so thank you for the call. 244-1777 is the local number, and just the number, I guess, here in at WDEV in Waterbury. And I wanted to also mention that I got an email the other day, which was, somewhat critical. And one of the complaints was that, talked about the OMB declaring holding up Ukraine aid. This involves, of course, the Trump impeachment case. OMB declaring holding up Ukraine aid was illegal. And you may want to mention, did the OMB also rule the Obama administration break the law 7 times. Once was the prisoner exchange of Bo Bergdahl for multiple high-level prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. And I did about a minute of research on this, and I discovered that it wasn't the OMB that was involved in declaring anything illegal. It was actually the GAO, the General Accountability Office. And the OMB is part of the White House, so I sort of had a guess that maybe the OMB wasn't going around declaring stuff the White House was doing illegal. And the other point I want to make about people who contact me and say, what about Obama this and what about Obama that? Obama hasn't been president for, 3.5 years or something like that. And frankly, we try to focus on the news here on the Dave Graham Show. And any complaints about Obama are now, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. This is a current events show, folks. And so some of that is, I may as well focus on whatever illegal activity somebody wants to allege by the administration of George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or all the way back to Ronald Reagan, heck, George Washington, I don't know, But the point is, I really do try to focus on what's current, and the other thing about Obama, of course, is nobody is considering whether to vote for him again. People are considering whether to vote for Donald Trump again for a second term. So really, the conversation about whatever's going on in the Trump administration, frankly, carries much more weight in my mind, just in terms of its currency and what matters, than any commentary about the Obama administration. This fellow was basically saying that by omitting these facts about the Obama administration, I was committing propaganda. Well, I really don't think so. I think I'm just trying to stay on what's current and what's relevant, and that's how you go, as far as I can tell. Hey, we are going to take a brief break for some bottom of the hour CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. When we return, we'll be talking with the Representative Kevin Christie, who is also chair of the State Human Rights Commission. We'll be back shortly, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Continuing into the second half hour of our program this Martin Luther King Monday, January the 20th, 2020. Want to introduce my next guest, who is a very accomplished Vermonter. He wears a couple of different hats right now. He's worn others before. Kevin Christie is a state representative from the White River Junction area. He's also chair of the State Human Rights Commission, which keeps track of issues of discrimination and problems like that in the state of Vermont. And wanted to check in with Kevin Christie, who I believe he came to Vermont. We'll double check with him in just a moment, but I believe he came to Vermont in the early 1970s. Obviously, Vermont's been through a lot of changes since then, and I want to gauge some of those changes through the eyes of Kevin Christie, in part because he's African American and has seen how Vermont has changed in the way it is a welcoming or maybe less welcoming, or we'll check in, find out about some trends or whatever from Kevin Christie, who's got this interesting piece of history here now, late 20th century, early 21st century, for people of color in the state of Vermont. And Kevin, also known as Coach Christie, welcome to the Dave Graham Show. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Hi, how are you, David?
I'm doing well, and I just want to thank you very much for being willing to join me this morning. I know some of these topics get a little sensitive sometimes, and I try to approach everything with an open mind and just fairness and decency and civility to all involved, and hope that others will join in, the callers and so on will, if they check in with us at 244-1777, will join us in the same framework and so on. So, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, first, your background. You were telling me the other day you did get to Vermont, I think at the age of 23, was it 1973?
Yes.
Okay, so and so you now have been here for almost 50 years, and give me the overall picture here. How has the state changed over time as a place to live, particularly for a person of color like yourself?
Oh wow, as you said earlier, it's an interesting discussion to have. Over time, I think that people are more sensitive to discussions of race. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has to do with just the fact that there are more people of color or mixed race and different ethnicities here in Vermont over these last 45, 50 years.
Yeah, it's becoming less of a rarity, I guess. Even when I first got here in the 80s, so, you know, a decade after you, I remember remarking to somebody that it seemed it was just very, very white, and I think the complexion is starting to change a little bit since those days, and it's certainly something that Howard Dean talked about this too. I remember when he was governor, he said the complexion of Vermont was starting to change, and of course this is back in the late 90s, early 00s, and he remarked on this and said, you know, and Vermonters need to be welcoming and ready for this change to continue and become more so over time. And so obviously others have noticed, and it is something which interestingly enough, we had a conversation with the head of the U.S. Committee for Immigrants and Refugees, as well as the economist Art Wolf a couple weeks ago on the show, where we were talking about Art's concern that Vermont's population has been dropping slightly. We were talking about whether immigration might be a counterbalance to or counterweight to that trend of dropping population. Of course, a lot of immigrants to the state now, especially up in the Burlington area, are coming from parts of the world, Africa, Asia, and they are people of color as well. So that's going to add to the rainbow here, is it not?
It has tremendously, actually. In the last 10 years or so, mm-hmm. with the refugee resettlement programs, especially, as you said, in the Burlington Winooski area, it's very, very noticeable. When you talk to the school officials in those communities in northern Vermont, what you find is that melting pot really is visible. I think Burlington has been varying anywhere from 35 to 40 different languages spoken in the school.
Yeah.
So that's very telling. And the same thing with South Burlington and Winooski and CVU isn't quite as large in that grouping. But it's very noticeable in those other two communities.
How do you think the schools there have done in terms of responding to these changes in the student population?
Well, there again, that's taken growth as well. I'll put it that way. As any group of people, institutions, be it law enforcement, be it education, starts to look at itself as far as how they work with their changing community. It takes time, intentionality, and effort.
Do you think that other communities around Vermont should be preparing right now for similar changes and for needing to make similar efforts?
Well, I think that that's going on. Vermont's good in a number of ways around adjusting to change. We do it well. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't.
Yeah.
It is that question that you brought up earlier. It's very sensitive when you talk about race. It's probably the most difficult discussion, not only we as Vermonters, but we as Americans have to discuss, because it affects people differently, and their impressions and feelings are different. And the lack of knowledge is even more so. I think we had a discussion when we were working on Act One last year, the ethnic studies bill, on your show, and that discussion about history, be it the Abenaki, our first Vermonters, or be it the Afro-American slaves, that actually, when you look at the historical detail, the first slaves came to America in 1619.
Okay. Which is the year before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that, you know, I mean, but our history books never said anything about that.
Well, you know, I have to say, I mean, and I'm gonna point the finger at myself here to some extent. I learned about the Tulsa race riots just last year when we were talking about this Act One and the need for some ethnic education in Vermont schools. And now refresh us. This was in the early 1920s, and it was a real attack that ended up with many residents of Tulsa, Oklahoma, people of color who had a relatively speaking, a pretty prosperous neighborhoods there, and so on and so forth, essentially being attacked, and there were many deaths in this what was a sort of a paramilitary, almost I guess, attack on the city of Tulsa, on the African American neighborhoods there. And you know, I think back to my U.S. history that I got in the eighth grade, and you get a second dose of it, or at least, you know, the way it was back then, get a second dose of it in 11th grade. Never a mention. Didn't ever come up.
Yeah. Well, what that's, as you know, history is written by the victors.
Yeah.
And going back to the Egyptians and the pharaohs. There were times that a pharaoh would erase, you know, the name of the preceding pharaoh. And so unless you did Egyptology, you'd never know that the other one existed. So we're kind of faced with that here. Forever, it appeared, you know, we were sub-humans. To this day, there are some, there are people who still believe that.
Yeah, and do you think there's any common theme there to the degree to which and the vehemence with which our current president has sought to erase so much of what was done by our previous president?
Well, that's a clear indication of a bias.
I mean, it seems to go beyond mere political differences. I guess, you know, if you really think the Paris Climate Accords were a dumb idea and you want to withdraw from them, okay. But I mean, there are some other policy actions that have occurred which just strike me as beyond broad policy differences, and more. They sort of feel like peak or something.
Well, it's pretty clear. I mean, if you were to. And I don't spend my time in that space personally, because we have too much work to do here
yeah.
at home.
Yeah, it's true.
It's frustrating as a human being, as a Vermonter, you know, as an American.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I can do personally is with my vote, and I'm glad I have that.
Yes, sir.
And that's being challenged around the country as well.
So let me ask you about bringing the lens back into Vermont, because obviously we don't have an unblemished record here in terms mm-hmm. of race relations, but I think a lot of Vermonters struggle to figure out where in their view of the situation here and sort of how large a blip on the radar screen should be, you know, that terrible situation that affected now former state representative Kaya Morris from Bennington. And this guy, Max Mish, rises out of somewhere and essentially harasses her out of office effectively. I think that would be a fair description of what occurred. Is that a reflection of Vermont? What is that? I mean, how do you sort of put it in an overall view of where Vermont stands on race relations and so on?
I would say, and I've said this before, and it's not trying to be a seer of sorts, but we know what we know, and we don't know what we don't know. So it's that's not a decree on any of us, because I learn something new every day.
Yeah.
You know, and if we're not willing to understand why people do the things they do and why we do the things we do, we're not going to make any progress.
Yeah, I mean, I think that search for understanding certainly is a very important key to progress when you think about how change is made and how change in individuals' attitudes can happen, mm-hmm. how change in overall government policy and so on can happen. Obviously, these things are it's a rough and frequently fraught relationship. But if you look at the overall arc of history, they do kind of go hand in hand. And at the beginning of our conversation, you were saying that it seems as though people are more sensitive to issues of race these days than when you first arrived in Vermont in the 1970s. Is that just a general social climate nationally? Is it more so or less so in Vermont? Or how does that kind of fit the overall arc of history?
Well, I think in certain parts of the country, people deal with that discussion differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's racism exists.
Yep.
And then I think we all know that. The question becomes, to what degree, if you had to put it on a spectrum, you know, what degree, you know, exists. So a more enlightened person might not have as many instances, you know, of bias, because they're trying very hard to understand themselves and how they interact with other people. And it's when I look at racism, there's overt racism. People would just get in your face or mm-hmm. give you that blaring stare. To covert, and that's the person that is just always, he or she knows how they feel, and they're going to let you know one way or another. But it isn't in your face, and that's a little more scary, because you can almost trust more what you can see and understand, you know, stand coming at you, whereas not knowing, it's almost always looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, I mean, I heard, actually, a friend of mine said a couple of years ago that the benefit to somebody having a, you know, using or displaying a Confederate flag is I think the line was, at least you know where they stand, as yes. opposed to somebody who's engaging in more subtle forms of racism and would deny it the instant anybody tried to raise it as an issue or whatever. That's a whole different sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, it's interesting, we'd have to spend a lot more time, and I would say there's a number of folks that I know in the state that I could suggest visiting with on a show about bias. These folks are doing trainings around the state to try to help people understand, you know, what it is and what it's about, because it's almost subliminal in a way. I'll just give you a brief definition, you know, if
sure.
for clarity. Unconscious biases, other forms of discrimination that can be affected by unconscious biases include ageism, sexism, homophobia, and ableism.
Mm-hmm.
One of the benefits of being aware of the potential impact of implicit bias, social biases, is that you can take a more active role in overcoming social stereotypes, discrimination, and prejudice. So, you know, when you look at what we're talking about in those areas, then it becomes a little more clear why it's such a difficult discussion with even your friends.
Yeah. No, I get what you mean. And talk to me a little bit about your work at the Human Rights Commission and what the commission is trying to do to deal with racial and other forms of discrimination in Vermont.
We just had our 40th anniversary last year.
Mm-hmm.
And the commission itself came into being to help mitigate, you know, those events around the state that did not protect not only people of color, but as I mentioned earlier about sexism and ageism and ableism, protected classes under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we do is we provide a protection for those classes of individuals that are being discriminated against, you know, or worse.
And has the commission's sort of workload or caseload or instances of discrimination reported to the commission gone up in recent years, or is it flat, or is it going down, or where are we in the overall trends of these kinds of things?
Well, that's an interesting discussion, and I think technically it goes with the times and people's let's say activism or awareness.
Mm-hmm.
My first appointment with the Human Rights Commission was under Howard Dean. He appointed me back during his last two. Well, actually, yeah, it was back in the 90s.
Okay.
And as you said, you know, he was concerned, and at that time, I was the only person of color on the commission.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you, you know, like a an indication as to where we were, you know, then. And during that time, also, the U.S. Human Rights Commission had completed a study of schools and the amount of harassment and bullying that was racially motivated in our schools. And it was determined that we had a lot of work to do here in Vermont because of the number of incidences that had been documented back then. And what's fascinating, and I from a research perspective, is that hasn't really changed much, even though a lot of energy has been put into changing that dynamic.
Wow, that's kind of disappointing to hear, I got to say, because you're right. I mean, work has been put in. Training's gone out to teachers and others involved in our educational system. And the goal is to improve stuff over time, right?
You would hope. But here is the one of the researchers that has been working on racial issues around the country did a TED talk, and the striking metaphor or situation that he mentions, and I've been sharing this lately with folks, and it becomes pretty clear what our issue is. If you think of learning and bias training and things that would help you mitigate systemic racism, it has to be worked on continually.
I guess it sounds like a problem that's going to be with us for a while. Kevin Christie, I really appreciate you talking with us this morning. Unfortunately, we're about out of time on this hour of the Dave Graham Show, but let's continue this conversation in the near future. These are obviously very important issues. Kevin Christie is the chair of the State Human Rights Commission and a state representative from the White River Junction area. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Alrighty, we're going to go to top of the hour, some news from CBS, words from our sponsors, and back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program this morning. We are going to be speaking in a few minutes with Mike Fisher. He is the healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid, and he's been collecting up testimony from Vermonters to the Green Mountain Care Board, which, of course, is the state panel that regulates healthcare. And this is in the context of the Green Mountain Care Board's annual review of insurance rates charged by Blue Cross Blue Shield MVP, the health insurance companies that serve Vermont. And boy, there were a lot of stories in those hearings about the difficulty Vermonters are having affording health care and getting access to it, and feeling like they then are also able to afford things like groceries and heat in the wintertime and so on. It's a lot of folks were describing a pretty dire picture out there, and Mike's office at Vermont Legal Aid has been working to collect up some of these stories, coming out with a new report talking about the voices of Vermont relating to healthcare. So we're going to be hearing about that beginning in probably about 10 minutes or so from now. Between now and then, I'd like to just open the phone lines again, 244-1777. Wonder if anybody has any thoughts about the conversation we just had with Kevin Christie, the chair of the Human Rights Commission, state representative from White River Junction. Kevin Christie was speaking to us on this Martin Luther King Day about the sort of state of the state in Vermont for people of color, African Americans, and others who are living in the state in greater numbers now than they have in the past. And this is something which is has been a trend in Vermont since I got here in the mid 1980s, and Kevin Christie was saying he came to Vermont in the early 1970s, and so we have had somewhat of a transition in the state over those decades since then, and something which continues and taking on a more even world flavor now, given the new arrivals, new Americans coming into the state from places like Somalia and other parts of Africa, the Middle East, some parts of Asia as well. So it is a time when Vermont is going through a transition, and as Governor Phil Scott was saying a couple of weeks ago, he was remarking that we need the influx to keep our population up and our economy vibrant and all that sort of thing. Of course, the governor wrote to President Trump to make clear that Vermont is a welcoming jurisdiction for immigrants and refugees into the United States as part of a formal federal process where states and localities were told, if you want to do this, you need to let us know, essentially, by the Trump administration. I noticed then Burlington Mayor Miro Weinberger followed up with a letter last week saying Burlington also wants to welcome refugees into the city. And so there is that that continuing effort in Vermont to be at least in large parts of the state to be a welcoming place for folks from around the world who by and large want to come here and make their way into our economy, work, and get themselves settled here, raise families, and do all the usual stuff of human existence here in the early 21st century. So I think oftentimes there are a lot of very, very cool and fascinating stories of people who come here from far distant places, different climates, and they have to adjust to the weather we were having this morning. Not always easy for even people who were born and raised here to get out of bed when it's 6 degrees, but we do it, and there you go. So, 244-1777. Let's go to a listener calling in, Belinda from Plainfield. Good morning, Belinda.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
And what's on your mind today?
Yes, I really appreciate it. I didn't get to hear the whole conversation, but I appreciated the guest you had on.
Just the last guest, Kevin Christie.
Yeah. Yep. And one of the things that it brought to my mind was the issue of the school-to-prison pipeline in Vermont. And I know that Vermont is consistently ranked as some of the best schools in the nation. And while that's true for many different reasons, we also have a lot of work to do in regards to the school-to-prison pipeline. And I know that what is happening in Vermont also mirrors a national trend of, and it's not just poor minority kids or black kids, it's also kids on the spectrum of autism and poor kids from low-income families that tend to be get over suspensions from school, over nitpicks, and suspensions don't work. And then the kids feel worse about themselves, have worse behavioral issues, and tend to do more poorly and are more likely to drop out of school and thus more likely to end up in jail later in life is how the thing goes. And I just think that would be a very, very important issue to start with. And I would hope the schools would look more into restitution and restorative justice, which has been proven time and time again to work.
Wow. Well, those are some interesting goals you described for our public schools. And a lot of our public schools are off today for the Martin Luther King holiday. To the extent school teachers and administrators are listening, I hope they heard your words there, Belinda, because you raised some very important issues, which have been highlighted by groups like the American Civil Liberties Union here in Vermont and the Human Rights Commission and others who are talking about this issue of how school discipline sometimes can create kind of a downward spiral for a kid, and that spiral can end up with the kid getting into trouble after graduating from high school, kind of getting on a path of being, you know, a social outcast and somebody who is automatically assumed to be misbehaving and so on and so forth. And so that is that school to prison pipeline is a tough conundrum and one which does deserve attention from. I appreciate you pointing it out. So I thank you very much for the call. And wanted to mention also that the Dave Graham Show is. I was talking a little bit a while ago about the emails that I sometimes get from listeners, and just want to. I'm on a little campaign here to remind folks that the best way to reach out to the Dave Graham Show, or really any, I'm sure any talk radio show, is to call the show, just as Belinda from Plainfield just did, to chat about whatever's on your mind. The issue with emails is that they can be pretty time-consuming if I try to go through them and responding to all of them, and time is short, I must say, just given the daily schedule of preparing shows for the air and lining up the guests, etc. It's a pretty busy situation, and so much better way than calling, rather much better way than emailing, is actually to call the show and bring your thoughts to bear here on our air. What we're really here for, and we do appreciate folks who are willing to do that. I know some people get nervous. I don't get nervous. I don't. I try not to bite anybody's head off unless I think they are, shall we say, not being completely honest and truthful here. Or if people start to get uncivil, then I will be pretty curt with people. But by and large, are people who call up and want to just make a point about their general observations of what's going on in the world. I hope it's a welcoming place and that nobody feels shy about calling 244-1777 and checking in with the show here. I think a lot of Vermonters have some very interesting perspectives and backgrounds and abilities to articulate their points of view, and that's what this whole enterprise is about here, folks, and really appreciate the willingness of those who are our regular callers and want to encourage a greater range. More, I'd love to have more women, frankly, calling in. So once again, thank you very much, Belinda, for that. We tend to have a predominance of male callers on the show, and I remember one time somebody accused me of prioritizing men's calls, and I was thinking, I don't prioritize between genders here. So let's bring on Frederica. I mean Fred from Newberry. Good morning, Fred.
That's a good one. Let's see here. Trump hasn't made my Social Security benefits increase, I don't think, more than one penny. Now, if the Democrats come into office and they make the corporations pay their fair share and the rich people pay their fair share, will my Social Security benefits increase?
Will your Social Security benefits increase? I think that as a general rule, I mean, my understanding of the issues with Social Security, and we actually have had people from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare on the program a number of times. And, you know, the real questions about Social Security is, will it be preserved in something that looks pretty much like its current form going into the, later 20s and 30s and so on?
Yeah, but I'm not worried about the future because my future is limited. Okay. Your future is a lot greater than mine.
Okay, so you're asking if you vote Democrat this fall, will you get an increase in your Social Security benefit I guess my only answer to you is A, I don't know. I mean, that would be a promise that's beyond my ability to tell you for sure. I think Social Security is by and large tied to the rate of inflation. They come up with a formula that says, you know, if inflation goes up X amount, then they do a little, they apply some math to that and figure out here's how big a bump you get in your Social Security check.
So making the rich pay their fair share is not going to increase my Social Security payments.
Well, you know, as I say, they are by law they are tied to inflation. I'm pretty sure, and so you know if inflation occurs at a steady or fast clip, then you'll see a bigger increase. Of course, it'll just be keeping pace because other stuff will cost more.
Right.
So the big bump you're looking for. I frankly doubt it. I don't see anybody having any life-changing increases in their Social Security income anytime soon. Really, I think what the game is right now is to try to sort of maintain the benefits to the degree they are there now. So that's the real, you know, I guess you're that is the real the real difference there. So. Hey, Fred, I got to go. We're going to bring in our next regularly scheduled guest here, or irregularly scheduled guest, or whatever like that. But I want to introduce once again Mike Fisher. He is the healthcare advocate for Vermont Legal Aid, and we wanted to talk about the issues connected with healthcare access and affordability in Vermont. A lot of people are feeling like those things are slipping out of their grasp, and I believe Mike Fisher's on the line with us this morning. Are you there?
I am here, Dave. Good morning, and good morning to everyone.
Good morning, and thank you very much for joining us this morning. You sent me a very interesting report over the weekend. That is this something that is due to come out soon, or is it already out, or what was the timing on this?
Well, it is already out. We just released it.
Mm-hmm.
It is called Vermonters' Voices. Healthcare doesn't work if you can't afford to use it.
Yeah. Wow. That is a pretty basic statement there, isn't it?
It is a pretty basic statement. And I think, as I start into this, I think it's really important to say that I'm not going to say anything that everybody listening doesn't already know. But my office is here to be a consumer voice and to advance consumer voices. And we thought it really important to take the comments that have come into the Green Mountain Care Board around insurance rate review and to advance them forward to maybe broadcast them in a different way, because I think they give a really important insight into what's going on in Vermont families related to the cost of care.
And this is I was looking through it, and there was a lot of testimonials in the material from Vermonters who are, frankly, these folks are struggling to cover the cost of their health care. Were these all based on, or were they recorded in hearings of the Green Mountain Care Board?
Well, the Green Mountain Care Board has a comment process, and so they invite Vermonters to give comment, and these are the written comments that came in during this past year's rate review. Small group, qualified health plan rate review process. So there were other comments that come in throughout the year, and some comments that come in that are given verbally during hearings. These are just the written ones.
And give us a sample. I mean, what were some of the more striking ones that you saw?
Well, I think I'd like to sort of point us towards one of the most troubling aspects. Everything we talk about in healthcare reform is trying to get people into the care they need when they need it. And the number of people who said things like, "I avoid seeking medical care as much as possible as it is for fear of exorbitant medical bills."
Yeah.
Or, "I, along with my family members and friends of mine, have deferred doctor's visits or procedures due to the cost. Healthcare should not be something that is out of reach for most Vermonters." Now I'm going to read another one. "The high cost of insurance combined with lack of adequate coverage has resulted in us skipping annual physicals and largely avoiding the healthcare system." And I could go on and on. There were over 600 comments. Many of them had themes about how the costs are impacting the way they get care, the way they save for savings. We heard from many Vermonters who run small businesses or who spoke on behalf of their businesses, who talked about the impact.
Yeah, and what is the overall trend in the ability or willingness of employers to provide their, you know, a strong support for employer-sponsored healthcare? I mean, are they maintaining their contributions, or are they scaling back and loading more onto the workers?
That's a good question. I think there are two. The end of your question changed a little bit. The number of employers that continue to give employer-sponsored insurance, the insight that we would have on that would be through the employer tax, the employer contribution tax, which my recollection, and I'd have to refresh, go back and look at it, but my recollection is that those revenues have been relatively stable. That is, that the number of employers offering employer-sponsored insurance has been relatively stable. But at the end of the question, you change to sort of the degree of coverage, and that points to a different dynamic, a trend about underinsurance. We do a survey here in Vermont every 3 years or so. The last one was in 2018, where there's a survey that is done asking Vermonters about health insurance and healthcare access. Mm-hmm. And it shows a really troubling trend. It shows a great trend around uninsurance. Our uninsured rate has remained very low, 3.2%, I think, in the last survey.
Yep.
But it shows a really troubling trend around underinsurance. And it's a relatively complicated calculation, but on a basic level, it is if you have deductibles that are over 5% of your income. In 2018, those of us who are commercially insured had an uninsured rate of 40%. And in 4 years earlier, the previous time in 2014 when that survey was done, it was 27%. So between 2014 and 2018, it went up on a trend from 27% to 40%. If you drew that line, if you continue to draw that line, if the rate of people moving towards high deductible plans continued at the same rate, we'd be up in the 60% range now.
And again, this is people who have insurance nominally do have insurance, but are unable to get the support they need from their insurance when they need it.
Yeah, I should be prepared to go back to another comment. People who are either because of their support from their employer, or maybe because of the support from a subsidy from the state, they are able to pay for their premiums, mm-hmm. but they continue to have very high deductibles.
I saw those, some of the comments where folks are chipping in. I think there was one family talking about chipping in $9,000 toward their monthly premiums every year, and then having a $15,000 deductible on top of that. Pretty soon you are assuming you use the system and you actually need to, I don't know, go to the hospital because you have pneumonia or some other illness or a chronic condition, perhaps. It suddenly becomes this sort of $30,000 or $40,000 monster.
Yeah, many people reported that they are on the hook for $30,000 if they're sick or their kids are sick. Yeah, I think deductibles are a little funky because some people say. If you're not sick, then a high deductible doesn't bother you. But there is also the dynamic, and it shows up in some of the comments I already read, where people are avoiding the care they need because they're afraid of the deductible. So it's hard to measure the impact of a deductible if people are avoiding care.
Well, and if you're avoiding care, you are once again probably, or in too many cases, let's put it that way, you are just going to create more costs for yourself and for the system down the road, because assuming that the whatever condition you might have caught early, you know, continues to progress, it gets worse, then it just becomes a bigger problem for all involved at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, and we are in the middle of a major effort to try and change the way we pay providers to incent them to do more upfront care, more wellness care instead of illness care. Mm-hmm. And that's a great effort. It's a good idea. It's something that it's a direction our healthcare system needs to go. But if people can't afford to get in the door in the first place, it kind of doesn't matter whether our providers are paid in a different way. People still won't show up.
Now, one of the things we've seen much coverage about in recent times is something called OneCare, the all-payer model, as I also see it called. How is that playing out, especially for the people you're there to help, by and large, moderate and lower income Vermonters who are already feeling the healthcare squeeze? Is this actually does this feel like progress to them?
You have reminded me that I have not given a plug to my helpline. So we run a helpline, you know, the Office of Healthcare Advocate runs a helpline mm-hmm. that's available to all Vermonters, not just low income Vermonters. And the number for that is 800-917-7787. And all Vermonters are welcome to call us if they're having challenges paying for care or, with a problem with their insurance company. Or any kind of access to care. Mm-hmm. So, but to get back to your question, yeah, I am accused by, you know, the insurance, by the regulators, by the Green Mountain Care Board and others of being impatient. I hear from Vermonters, my team hears from Vermonters every day who are in the panic of not knowing how they're going to get the care they need. And while there is a hopefulness in theory that the all-payer model is going to bend the cost curve, and it's too early to really measure. It's only been with us for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. We do hear from many Vermonters who are still in that same panic of not knowing how they're going to be able to get the care they need.
One of the things that I am sometimes bothered by, and this is sort of a real big picture question, but I do ask sometimes, are we expecting too much and placing, frankly, too much demand on our healthcare system? Is there any way to better manage the public's expectations in terms of what the healthcare system can deliver, what they're going to get for the money, or is there really enough slack in the system itself that we would be into that's the first place to go?
Well, I am convinced that there's a lot of waste in our healthcare system. I know that many people go directly to, you know, the very high salaries of the people at the top, and while that's true, I also am convinced that these giant systems are good at feeding themselves. They also provide a lot of really important care that people need, mm-hmm. and it does go to, you know, how do we pay for it and what level of support do Vermonters need? Let me shift a little bit. Let me read another one.
Okay.
Just to change the conversation a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
I am the director of a nonprofit agency serving older Vermonters in central Vermont. Rising health insurance rates would, by the amount proposed, would be an extra $37,000 for my agency. What would we do with $37,000? Would we buy an extra 10,000 Meals on Wheels for older Vermonters? Would we, or could we pay for 1,800 hours of respite care for a caregiver for someone with dementia, and so on.
Yeah, obviously. And that gets us back to, for households and for organizations, businesses, and others, competing demands for that are being, budgets being eaten up by healthcare costs. Let's talk more about that and other issues connected with all of this after the break. We're going to go to hear some CBS News at the bottom of the hour. Mike Fisher, the healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid, I hope will stay with us. And I hope listeners will as well. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Back talking with Mike Fisher, the healthcare advocate with Vermont Legal Aid, about access to care, the cost of care, the worries many, many Vermonters have about how can we afford to get a good service from our healthcare system when bills are just really high, when insurance premiums are really high, when copays and deductibles seem sky high. Meanwhile, we have other expenses in our life, trying to keep a car on the road, trying to keep the house heated or the apartment heated, et cetera. Let's go to a listener who's on the line this morning. Ruth is calling in from Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yes, Mr. Fisher knows that I think that health insurance is a worthless product because people can't afford to pay for the insurance policy and then their high deductibles. He knows that because I've mentioned it to him. But I'm wondering, the insurance rates went way up, and Vermont Health Connect was enrolling new people. Did a lot of people, does he know if a lot of people dropped buying health insurance?
Mike Fisher, what do you know about that? Do these increases cause people to just drop off the rolls and sort of hope they don't get sick?
Hello, Ruth.
Yeah.
Good to hear from you. We don't yet. I have yet to see the outcome of this most recent open enrollment to see whether there were any major trends. We don't get to see. It's hard for us to measure how many people left the Vermont Health Connect plans to go to other kinds of plans until we see the household survey. This is one of the reasons why I've pushed for the household survey to be done more often. So we don't have an answer to that question as to whether we're seeing more people go uninsured.
Well, the number one topic of conversation when we gathered at Thanksgiving was not Donald Trump's impeachment. It was, what are we going to do with these new increased charges? And a lot of people in my family had pre-existing conditions like cancer, so they could not cancel their insurance, but they're paying a ridiculous amount.
Yes.
Okay.
And Ruth, let me ask you, are you hearing from them that they are then struggling to meet other needs like food and heat and so on?
Well, I know some people are going without care. I know that. Mm-hmm. And I have been saying that for years.
And Ruth, you don't like health insurance. You've called before and said health insurance is a scam. Do you think that it would be better off in a system where people just go and pay directly for their own care? Or what would replace a health insurance system?
Well, unfortunately, health insurance is it just gives you no comfort at all. It's just a huge expense. It would be better if you went without it and you just paid up front when you went to the doctors. Yes, I believe that. And let's say you're worried that you might have a catastrophic event. Even if you did, even with health insurance, you would still go bankrupt. That's how bad the situation is.
Yeah, it is. It's also quite mysterious, sort of where the charges come from and how the bill gets down to what it gets down to, and so on and so forth. It's a bizarre process. Not enough transparency, if you ask me. But Ruth, I thank you for the call. I think you make interesting observations here.
I've been calling about this way back when Mark Johnson was on.
Yep.
WDEV is very lucky that I call in all the time.
I think we are too.
People about this.
Yep.
Thank you.
Alrighty, Ruth. Take care. And Mike Fisher, let me ask you a question, because somebody showed me a bill just the other day where they had they went for an overnight stay at one of our regional hospitals here in Vermont, it was a sort of a flare up of a chronic condition they have, and the bill, the total charge from the hospital was $9,000 and change. And then there was this allowed amount in which Blue Cross was going to pay $4,500, and then the patient at the end of the letter, the patient was told you owe zero. How did that work out?
Well, I assume that works out because that's what their insurance is covering. But I think that you make a good point by raising this question and by Ruth's question. Health insurance is expensive in large part because health care is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And health care is expensive for many reasons. And we our state's gone down some different roads on this, but there is also quite a bit of waste in this system due to our financing system. And, this is the system we have. I mean, we are now covering health insurance, our healthcare needs through this system of third-party insurance companies that is leaving many people out. In the short term, there's not a lot I can call for other than increased supports for people who are in need. It's interesting, this year the administration came forward with a report that said that we could drop insurance rates, insurance costs, premium costs by 10% with a $2 million investment, by 10% for people between 4 and 500% of the federal poverty level. So it's sort of a sweet spot where there's a lot of expense, moderate income families, with a $2 million investment. I think we need to go back to those conversations in the short term, as long as we're continuing with this system, to try and make sure people can keep going to the doctor when they're in need.
Yeah, it is a. It sounds like we're always in this sort of state of trying to fix the car when it's rolling down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Because people do need it immediately, and so and on a continuing basis, and there are new immediate needs popping up every day all over the state. It's just fascinating to me that we have this kind of system the discussions happen year after year in the House Healthcare Committee, which you used to chair. Just also strike me as part of this very difficult process of trying to make improvements in a system which is in full operation and continuing, feels like a shakedown cruise sometime or something, doesn't it? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, I want to say as clearly as I can, I would support a move towards a different kind of financing system, one where people didn't feel so exposed, weren't so exposed by their health status. I don't see that on the immediate horizon, given national leadership, let alone state leadership.
And, yep.
So it leaves us with trying to tinker around the edges. The analogy I always remember, we always used to make was not the car rolling down the road, but the plane flying. we gotta repair this thing while we're in the air.
While we're in the air, yeah.
There's no setting down to take a break. So we find ourselves advocating for minor changes, like the one I just suggested of, recognizing an income range where people are particularly exposed and suggesting fixes for that income range, or for particular illnesses such as diabetes care.
Yeah.
Where people, the cost, the human and financial cost of not being treated is so exorbitant. We should be paying people to get good diabetes care. And yet we still saddle people with exorbitant costs and prior authorizations. You know, nobody's getting a continuous glucose monitor for fun because they're trying to scam the system. People want it because they need it. And yet we set up prior authorization systems as if to say to people, do you really need it? After their doctors, you know.
That one is a weird one. I mean, I would agree with you. I can't imagine anybody deciding that having a continuous glucose monitoring is that's anybody's definition of a good time. That's just sort of something you need to do if you have a very specific condition called diabetes. And if you do have this very specific condition, it's pretty vital you get that, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, the human and the financial costs of not being well cared for are so exorbitant. Our system does things. You know, we do prior authorizations and things like that because we have done them, and because things, you know, these things cost a lot of money. But
yep. Hey, another listener on the line. Let's go to George in Berlin. Good morning, George.
Hey, Dave. Hi to your guest too. I'm self-employed, and I know my premiums just went up at least $100 this last time. And you know, for a silver plan, for me and the wife, it's over $1,000 a month, and I think it's $8,000 deductible between the two of us, $4,000 each. But my question is, what's the rest of the country look like for their premiums? You know, once we make over $60,000 or $62,000 a year, there's really no assistance in your health care. And I was just wondering what the other states look like. I mean, because it really, it just saddles you with a huge payment every month.
Well, that is a question. Where does Vermont rank these days, Mike, on the health care affordability picture?
So it's a simple question with a complicated answer. Vermont is one of only two states that doesn't do something called age rating. That is, we charge people the same amount across the whole age range.
Mm-hmm.
Most states do some amount of variation. The Affordable Care Act, I believe, allows for a 3-to-1 age range. That is, you can charge people at towards the Medicare side three times more than you charge people when they're younger. This means that when you look at our average rates, they look high, because often the average rate is based on, let's say, a 40-year-old. But when you account for that difference, we're actually doing a little bit better than the rest of the country in terms of our costs. I have to pause and say, careful who you compare yourself to. Doing better than the rest of the country here might not give anybody any solace. The numbers George just gave, $8,000 of deductible and $1,000 of premiums, I assume for a family of two, you know, that's a significant bill.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. And I think that's what a lot of families are seeing when they were thinking about, you know, am I going to be able to afford that much needed new vehicle over the course of the next year or something? Or am I going to be able to put any money aside to, you know, for kids' college education or any number of other big expenses people face in life? When healthcare keeps galloping along like this, it really makes the overall effort to keep a family budget in reasonable shape more and more difficult. And it's quite a worry. Let me ask you in general terms, and I want to get into some specifics about what legislation might be pending this year to address various parts of this giant conundrum. But what are the long term solutions here? I gather there's no real silver bullet, but I mean, are there any efforts that you see that can actually, you know, help to bend the curve or whatever?
Well, the first thing is to recognize that we are a part of a federal system and highly dependent on actions taken at the federal level. And as everybody knows, there are there's a rich conversation about the directions to go to make this thing better, and a very active conversation about how to pull it apart, or whether it's going to come apart. And so I have to admit that a decent amount of my advocacy is defensive at the moment, given movements from the federal, from the Trump administration.
I'm sorry, a decent amount of your advocacy is what? Defensive, you said?
Defensive, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as they propose various things that on one level or another make it threaten Vermonters' ability to get the care they need. So
in terms of, if I ask you a question, how are we going to make some progress on this? You're in more of a crouch saying we got to hold the line against the regress or whatever.
Well, I think there are real opportunities about how to improve the Affordable Care Act, I think the conversation on the federal level about a national healthcare financing system, a Medicare for all, if you will, are really important conversations. Now, I am also a realist, and I understand that whoever wins any primary or any election, we are stuck with the current system that we have for a while, and there are some more minor changes that could make Vermonters' lives better. And so there are a number of bills that and discussions happening in the State House. I think that there will be some conversation about prescription drug costs, and actions that can be taken on that level to figure out new ways to put limits on the ever ballooning costs of pharmaceuticals.
What specifically are we talking about when we are saying there may be some legislation on this front?
Well, I know that there's been some legislation introduced. It's hard for me to measure or predict where the committees are going to go or the legislature is going to go this year. But I think there's some interesting bill that I believe either has or is about to be introduced about the cost of insulin. Just a link back to the conversation we were having before.
Yep.
I think that there is an interesting bill about trying to create a new format for evaluating and putting limits on the cost of drugs. A prescription drug affordability board is framed up in a bill that was introduced in the House and the Senate. With an interesting twist on how to accomplish this, and instead of not telling pharmaceutical companies what they can charge, but instead saying, "Here's what Vermont is willing to pay."
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody listening should say immediately, "We're so tiny. How could we have an impact?" but the concept of this is a conversation that was, I think, started in Maryland and has moved to Maine and now Vermont. And so the concept of a number of states taking this kind of stand on particular pharmaceuticals, like insulin, for instance, where we start to have a collective influence.
Yeah, banding together. And actually, then you're not so small anymore once you're part of a group, perhaps. So that is that in prospect for this year, or is that a years-long process to try to get all these states on board, or what are we thinking?
Yeah, that's a long-term prospect. It's probably a long-term prospect to get it passed in Vermont, even.
Mm-hmm.
But the conversation started, and I think it's an interesting one. I'm curious about it. I think that this year the legislature will be spending some real time on workforce. There has been for some
healthcare workforce.
Yes.
Yeah, boy, that is an issue because a lot of our healthcare doctors' offices and hospitals struggle to find people. Frankly, if you are If you are interested at all in healthcare, there are careers out there for folks to get into. Tons of incentives now, new training courses being offered, for instance, at CVMC to move yourself from the LNA level up to LPN and registered nurse, and get your education paid for, and you get yourself possibly into a real profession that pays well. It's a good middle class living once you get up into the registered nurse ranks, for instance.
Yeah, there is a recognition. Like I say, this has been true. We've known this for some time, but there is a feeling like we're approaching a crisis point with the number of, whether you're talking about dentists or primary care docs or other specialties, when you look at the demographics of who our providers are, their age and their likely retirement, and the challenge of competing with other states to get those providers not only into our urban center and not only into Burlington, but into, throughout our state. That's a tremendous challenge.
Yeah, the challenges are tremendous. They are large and huge and very, I don't want to say intractable, but they're difficult. And I certainly respect the work you're doing to try to help unravel some of these problems, and as well as the work being done in the legislature on this front. This is not easy stuff. A lot of people working in the field, in the healthcare, in the hospitals, and so on, are really trying to put their heads together to come up with solutions.
I realize we're coming to the top of the hour. I just have to say, and it is my hope that the legislature will also put some energy into the affordability challenge that we started our conversation with.
Yeah.
And taking some real steps to protect Vermonters.
Mike Fisher, you have a toll-free number that folks can call for help from your office, right?
Yes. Please, if you have any kind of question about your care and something that your insurance company is doing or your provider, we're not doctors, but we help people get access to care. It's 800-917-7787.
800-917-7787. Phone number for Vermont Legal Aid, Office of the Healthcare Advocate. Mike Fisher, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That's going to about do it for the Dave Graham Show on this Monday morning. And stay tuned now for Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio. And have a great afternoon, everybody. We'll talk again tomorrow.